Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz Today.
Well, hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Tony Katz Today. I'm Andrew Langer in Today, in Tomorrow. As you all know, I am the frequent radio fill-in host here and elsewhere. I also run the Center for Regulatory Freedom at the CPAC Foundation and host three podcasts, not one, not two, but three podcasts. Andrew and Jerry Save the World, new bonus episode out today. My interviews with the aforementioned John Schweppe, as well as Doug Collins, former congressman from Georgia. I do Swamp Secrets, Exposing Regulatory Dark Matter. We've got a couple of episodes coming up on that. That's available at the CPAC website. And then, of course, Andrew and Jerry, I said that already, The Lunch Hour, Federal Newswire, which is my deep dive interview show. You can find that wherever fine podcasts are found. Both of those, both that and Andrew and Jerry Save the World, available out there. This week's episode is with Tim Lee from the Center for Individual Freedom. That's a good one to talk about. We're going to talk about some of those issues later on. This hour, we're going to be joined by Mel Kay, podcaster and author Mel Kay. She's going to join us, as well as Andre Yanku with Sullivan and Cromwell, to talk about intellectual property things, what's going on with the Biden administration. We've been talking about gaslighting. Actually, I want to start here because we had a victory yesterday. When we were talking with John Schweppe, I tied together this issue of the attack on religious freedom with what we saw yesterday, this alleged proposal. There's some debate as to whether or not it was a real proposal to remove that iconic statue, the Kiss in Times statue, photograph, the Kiss in Times Square, a sailor kissing a nurse or dental assistant, depending on who you talk to. Upon the news of America's victory over Japan in World War II, this bureaucrat allegedly took it upon herself, this undersecretary, to demand the removal of this picture because she claimed that it promoted a non-consensual sexual activity. There's a lot of debate about that. Well, they pulled it back. The hue and cry was swift and vigorous, no doubt triggered in no small measure to me and talking about it on the show and on social media, etc. Well, Corinne Jean-Pierre got asked about this. Here's what she had to say. Here is number 10.
One of the Federal Affairs running an effort to ban the display of that that iconic Times Square kiss photo on BJA at the end of World War II. Was anyone at the White House consulted in the drafting of the initial memorandum? And then did anyone at the White House call up the Secretary of Veterans Affairs and say rescind that memo?
So I want to be really, really clear. The VA is not going to be banning this photo from VA facilities. So I just want to be super, super clear about that. I know, as you just said, you described it as a kerfuffle. There was obviously some reporting on that. I can say that I can definitely say that the memo was not sanctioned. And so it's not something that we were even aware of until you all started reporting on it. But we are not banning that photo. And I'm just going to be super clear about that. Any specifics about the memo and the process over there, certainly I would refer to the VA.
But the problem, of course, is that even if it's some bureaucrat freelancing, this is part and parcel of what happens when you signal from the top that you are going to erase history, right? That you're going to change the cultural iconography to fit the narrative, the prevailing narrative of the executive branch. You cannot be surprised when a bureaucrat at the National Park Service takes it upon themselves to remove a statue of William Penn. You cannot be surprised when a bureaucrat over at the VA takes it upon themselves to remove an offending picture. And I use offending in quotes because I don't think it's an offensive picture at all. By the way, I didn't talk about this yesterday. This functionary over at the VA, I mentioned it, is emblematic of people falling forward. You go and look at her record at the VA and the various writings that people have done, especially Luke Roshek used to be at the Daily Caller. When he was still at the Daily Caller, he wrote a piece about her mismanagement of VA facilities in the past. Was she fired? No, she was promoted. She landed as an undersecretary. You know, it really is the Soviet-style bureaucracy at work. They had these people in the Soviet Union, these apparatchiks in the Soviet Union, that were called Zampolits. They were political officers. They had no competency beyond parroting and executing the party line within an organization. You know, made famous in the movie The Hunt for Red October, where they the political officer gets killed by Captain Ramius, Sean Connery. The political officer serves no purpose other than to make sure that the party orthodoxy is being exercised. That's what happens here. And so this woman, who had no real organizational skills, she mismanaged these various hospitals. It's on the public record here. She gets promoted and has a 30-year career where she lands as undersecretary. And what is one of her public acts to try to get this photo banned? So I want to play this. I'm going to come back to some of these other things later on. But this was an important one as well. There was this exchange yesterday in the press briefing that Corinne Jean-Pierre gave. And we've been spending a lot of time talking about the president's mental state. And you want to talk about the gaslighting of America. Watch the deftness with deft, D-E-F-T, the deftness with which Corinne Jean-Pierre handles this question. Let's play cut number 11.
If I may, the president, I noticed, had note cards at the border when he was doing his briefing there. He also had note cards last Friday with the Italian prime minister. Why does the president rely so heavily on note cards?
You're upset because the president has note cards? You're asking me a question about the president having note cards?
I'm asking why.
The president, who has had probably one of the most successful first 3 years of an administration than any modern day president. He's done more in the first 3 years than most presidents who had two terms. You're asking me about note cards? I'm not speaking to you right now, James. I'm talking to your friend over here, Ed. So thank you so much. But thank you so much for interjecting. Go ahead, Ed.
I was just asking why he relies so heavily on note cards.
I think what's important here and what the American people care about is how this president is delivering for them. And that's what he's doing. And that's what's the most important thing here.
No, okay. Again, you talk about the gaslighting here. First of all, the president isn't delivering for Americans. Gas prices are up 30 cents a gallon in the last week. You know, we are experiencing this issue of shrinkflation. All of these things are just it's bad. There are so many issues when you go to the store and you're paying more for less. So the president isn't delivering. Yes, he is. Changing the relationship that people have with their government in a fundamental way. He may have done more than that in the last 3 years than any other president. I'm not sure that that's really where you want to go with all of this. But the question fundamentally is, on people's minds, is the president's mental state, both Republicans and Democrats. So the question of whether or not he is heavily relying on note cards is a very different question than the president using note cards. I mean, this, you know, we don't need a president who has to rely, in the same way we don't need a press secretary who has to have a massive briefing book in front of her the entire time. And I'm sorry, Corinne Jean-Pierre, that you are not at a point in your job where you can't just answer questions, where you don't have the capacity to answer questions without you also relying on this. I have a great deal of question about that in your competency. By the way, real quick before we go to the break, because I do want to talk. You talk about the gaslighting here. Let's play cut number 7.
How's President Biden going to fix the border if he can go years without talking to the head of Border Patrol?
He was literally just with the chief of the Border Patrol, just this past Thursday in Brownsville, Texas. You all reported it. You all saw it. He was with the chief, Chief Owens, I believe.
The chief, who was in charge for 2 years before that, said, "I've never had one conversation with the president or the vice president." How is that possible?
So one thing I will say about Chief, you're talking about Chief Ortiz.
This is Chief Ortiz. Yeah.
So he was invited, I believe, to participate in the president's first trip, visit to El Paso, which was back in January of 2023, and he did not attend. He was invited. He did not attend. What I can say is that you saw the president with the present chief, which I think is important because we are dealing with challenges at the border, because the president has make that a priority, worked with the Senate in a bipartisan way.
Okay, all right, full stop. Also doesn't answer the question. Yeah, the president, 2 years into his term, invited the head of CBP to come and meet with him. I don't remember why the head of CBP didn't go. But the point is, there was 2 years before that. There was time in between when the president did away with those 97 executive orders in terms of how to deal with the border and when the president finally invited him to the head of CBP to meet with him. That's gaslighting. Blaming the head of the CBP for the president not meeting with the head of the CBP. That's just insane. Listen, when we come back, we're going to be joined by Mel Kay. We're going to talk to her about these things. I'm Andrew Langer, in for Tony Katz. This is Tony Katz Today. Been very excited to have this guest on. Her name is Mel Kay. She is an author. She is the host of the Mel Kay Show. She is a truth seeker, and I want to get her take. So, Mel, Super Tuesday was yesterday. Trump is off the hook with the Supreme Court. Nikki Haley is out. Your thoughts on all of this?
Well, it's going in the right direction, that's for sure. And I think we all really need to kind of take a step back and breathe and feel good about where we are right now. But we also have to be very honest about how we got here and that we have some big problems that I call the fourth branch of our government that needs to be handled. We all were, you know, in a state of trauma and you know, wanting answers after 9/11 and entered into this very unconstitutional Patriot Act. And a lot of what's gone on since 2016 to this day is spawned out of that and what has been created out of it. And I think going forward, we're going to have to be really cognizant that there are a lot of people that have been manipulating this country and certainly the persecutions of Donald Trump trying to get him kicked off the ballot. We need to start focusing on those people because they are running this country as a fifth kind of column above, and all of us have to pay attention. They are losing, and that makes them very dangerous. And I think that we need to all kind of unite, forget the Nikki Haley thing. It was some kind of, you know, military industrial complex, like Hail Mary. It's over, and we have to really focus on what needs to be done in this nation, not just between now and the election, but honestly after the election.
You know, it's interesting because I've had a couple of conversations with Pedro Israel Horta, the former CIA case officer. I don't know if you've talked to him yet. He has a great book out called The Broken Whistle, in which we talk about the same thing, the problem of the sort of this incestuous relationship between the folks who are supposed to be doing oversight over the intelligence community and the intelligence community itself. Clearly, there's got to be some reform there, don't you think?
Oh, 100%. There's multiple things that happened here. And we have to remember the people that are really running. If anyone thinks that Fannie Willis or Letitia James or Alvin Bragg or even Jack Smith are running these operations, they have to really dig a little deeper. These people aren't brain surgeons. They're not the best legal minds. You know, who's really doing this? Well, I will tell you, we need to go back, and I know people don't want to do that, but the there's been a lot that's come out lately about the CIA, which I find very interesting. There seems to be a CIA PR campaign going on. But what
there
we
is.
Did, and what we have known all along is that nobody investigated the lead up to Crossfire Hurricane,
right.
And nobody really is looking at what did Barr and Durham really do. What they did was they protected the fourth branch of government, and the question is why. And this track and trace surveillance.
Mel,
we're watching the entire. Go ahead.
You're speaking my language here because nobody has asked the question: why did Nellie Orr, former CIA case officer, married to Bruce Orr, senior Justice Department official, and integral in Crossfire Hurricane, she goes and works for the firm was that was doing the Oppo
GPS.
Research. She gets
right.
Fusion GPS. She goes and gets a ham radio operator's license for her home. Nobody asks the question, well, gee, why did you, right before you engaged in this activity with former British intelligence officer Chris Steele, why'd you go and get a ham radio operator's license? You just get an interest in doing shortwave radio? I mean, these are the questions that I want to have answered, but nobody's asking them, are they?
Right. And this is really, really important as to where we are, because there are multiple people that have been involved the whole time. Andrew Weissman, Norm Eisen, Mary McCord, all these people were involved in every single Get Trump lawfare, all the lawfare people at Brookings. And they're still doing it now. They're above all of this, and Nellie Orr is one of them. The problem is between 2016 and 2020, there was legitimate treason, sedition, there was coercion, all kinds of things going on behind the scenes. There were people in our government, outside our government. You know that there was a big thing recently about renewing the 702 that they
sure.
could get without warrant surveillance. If we do not deal with this stuff head on, at least call it out and make it mainstream, have the people of the United States understand. Forget Donald Trump. You have to understand that all of that set up for his campaign to be spied on, and then for them to continue spying on
right.
a sitting U.S. president. Well, guess what? They're trying to set it up again. Right now, in April, the 702 warrantless surveillance is supposed to expire, and we should all be demanding it does. Because that is how they got away with destroying, kneecapping, and infiltrating the Trump presidency from 16 to 20. And then all those same people were involved in the Transition Integrity Project, which was a
right.
year before the election. They all conspired for 2020. Molly Ball wrote that article admitting it. And just a few weeks ago, Mary McCord, one of the architects of this entire 8 years, which is not against Trump. It is against Trump voters that will not go with this globalist governance nonsense of Agenda 2030. That's who they're after. And when Trump says they're not after me, they're after you, it's really they're not after America. They're after the world. They want this global governance. The United States, the people of this country, will never, ever allow that. So the war is on us, patriots. And they've turned us into domestic terrorists. The entire campaign, we have to really look at 2024 is about ideology. What do you want for the future of this country? Do you want to be globalist citizens in a globalist cog, in a globalist banking system that is really running everything? Or do you want to take back America, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and our promise and our purpose in life and in being the United States of America, this beacon of freedom? Because that's what's on the line.
Just real quick, so many of our guests in the last couple of days have been about various aspects of this. John Burlow from the Competitive Enterprise Institute the other day talking about the Recoup Act and this issue of the banking system being weaponized against individuals. Yesterday we had Steve Baker on, the reporter for Blaze, who was
it.
Just arrested.
Yeah.
He said a thing to me yesterday. He was like, yeah, you know, they interviewed me in October of 2021. They said basically they were going to send over a couple of guys, or I was going to go meet with a couple of guys. And it was the exact same verbiage that Jim Comey used internally when he was going after Mike Flynn to, again, kneecap the White House, the National Security Advisor. Oh, let's go take advantage of chaos at the White House. We'll send over a couple of guys. They'll never know what would have hit them. I think you're absolutely correct here, and it's important for all of us to stand up. I mean, I think certainly we got a resounding indication of that yesterday with Super Tuesday, and certainly with some of the polling that we're seeing out there, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. And the other thing that happened, and I hope everyone saw it, these intel operators, they're not journalists. MSNBC is an intel operation. It's from top to bottom, just like Comcast and NBC. They're all in on it. And you have to wonder why. And I'm telling you, I believe that they are invested mind, body, spirit, fortunes, futures in the global governance model that is being championed, obviously, by probably the most powerful person in America for whatever reason, Larry Fink at BlackRock. Mm. And we have to understand that these people have totally left the people of the United States out in the cold, and it is not left and right. It is not Republican and Democrat. All their pushes for not having ID and all the things that they pretend that they're doing for voting, it's all those same people that are behind
right.
it. Norm Eisen, especially, Crew, all the Mark Elias. The question has to be why? Why are the American people, and it's not, they don't care about the Democrats. If they cared about the Democrats, why are they filling them with toxic hate and lies
right.
every day? If you really are champions for people, you give them positive stuff. You fight on the issues that matter. That's not what they've done. They've made a toxic culture purposefully to divide this country. We're all equally victims of this fourth intel kind of overreach. And I believe that intel group, like you're talking about Steve Baker, this warrantless
yeah.
surveillance, what Holder and Obama put in, that DOJ, Department of National Security, they're spying on tons of us. I'm sure me and you are on the list. But I'm telling you right now that every American citizen needs to look at this. There's a case right now of the Amish farmer in Pennsylvania. Another case. The American people should be up in arms. This is a dismantling of the Constitution.
Hey, Mel. Unfortunately, we got to leave it there. The Mel Kay Show. You can find her. The Mel Kay Show on Twitter. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, sir.
Got to get you back. That was Mel Kay. Go and check her out on the Twitter machine. Oh, my God. So much there. Listen, we're going to shift gears back to intellectual property with Andre Iancu. I'm Andrew Langer. This, of course, is Tony Katz Today. You know, it is a rare enough privilege to talk to someone who used to head up the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. I am privileged to have talked to now that this will be my second interview with such a person in the space of a week. Last week, I talked with David Kapos, who was head of PTO under Barack Obama. Joining me right now is Andre Iancu. He is also the former head of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office under President Trump. He's a partner at Sullivan & Cromwell. So glad you could join us. Also, he's a fellow Romanian American. I myself am a Romanian American as well. But we talked a little bit earlier with somebody about a little bit about the Bayh-Dole march-in situation. I alluded to my conversation with David Kapos about this. But let's talk about this, Andre. This issue of the undermining of intellectual property rights in the name of some nebulous ideological goal.
First of all, did not know that you're a Romanian American as well. We'll have to discuss that separately.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's going on here is that the Biden administration is trying to reinterpret a law that's been on the books for 44 years, and this would be the first time it is subject to such reinterpretation. And the stated goal is to reduce drug pricing. They want to say that this law, the Bayh-Dole Act, can be used by the federal government to seize patents if the patent owner, the manufacturer, sets prices that are unreasonably high, whatever that might mean.
Whatever that might be, yeah.
Exactly. And if the prices are too high, they can seize the patents and the technology in an effort to reduce the price of drugs. However, it wouldn't work, and we can discuss why that is.
Sure.
But more importantly, this proposal is not limited to drugs or pharmaceuticals in any way. It is all-encompassing, and it would apply to any industry, any technology that uses federal funds at any level.
And I want to be really clear about this. This is really important because, again, we're doing a show from Indiana here. The Bayh-Dole Act, B-A-Y-H, is named for Birch Bayh, who was a senator from Indiana for many, many years, along with Bob Dole, a piece of bipartisan legislation. What I want you to talk about, because, again, this is what I love about this issue, is that it's bipartisan. I hate the issue because it shouldn't be happening. But about the role of this act in spurring innovation, what was going on in innovation, especially in the pharmaceutical world, before the passage of the Bayh-Dole Act in 1980, and what did the Bayh-Dole Act do afterwards, and what's at risk here?
Yeah, so this is all about research that is based at least in part on federal funds, mostly done at universities and other federal labs. And before the Bayh-Dole Act, if a university or a professor would use some federal funds and would generate an invention and therefore get a patent on it, the federal government would effectively have the right to license that patent, and that right did not belong to the university. And because the federal government controlled all of that innovation space, as you can imagine, nothing actually happened. The innovations did not move from the university lab to the market, because industry was not willing to invest the heavy dollars it takes to bring a product to market, to build factories, et cetera, if the federal government would be controlling all aspects of that technology. So Senators Bayh and Dole saw that in 1980 and promulgated this this bill. It is bipartisan, as you've indicated. And as a result of that act, now those patents are owned and fully controlled by the universities. What that means is that they can license these patents. Industry can invest in them. Industry can build factories around them. And rest assured that once a product is brought to market, they can monetize it as they would any other commercial as any other commercial product. The concept here is that what the Biden administration wants to do is to say, okay, if that happens and the prices are too high, now we can go back on this and come back to you and take over this product. If that if they actually implement this, okay, if they actually, you know, take this proposal and make it law, then we would revert to pre-1980 to a pre-1980 system in which industry would shy away from all these inventions and they would just languish on the university shelf.
It's amazing to me because the statutory language is clear. And you know, that's what I want to ask you. It's something I talked about with David Kapos last week. You know, we're going through all of this debate over the post-Chevron world. And the Chevron doctrine at least hinges on the idea that there is language that is open to interpretation. And so if it's an okay interpretation of the statutory language, well, then the agencies are going to be given deference. In this instance, the statute explicitly says that they can't do this, yet they're going to do it anyway. This seems to be completely violative of the Administrative Procedure Act, which says that an interpretation can't be arbitrary, capricious, and abuse of discretion or otherwise not in accordance with the law. Talk about how can they do this with a straight face?
Well, this is the unfortunate situation of the current state of politics. They're willing to do this and flaunt the law. And hope that that either nobody notices, or if they do, you have to file a lawsuit, let that lawsuit percolate in the courts for however long it takes, and during that period of time, 3, 4, 5 years, whatever, however long it takes, all the way through the appellate process, they can operate a system that's outside the scope of the law. It's unfortunate. I frankly believe it is illegal and it's not in good faith. It is so clear, as you've said, on the face of the law, that price cannot be used as a criteria for the government to march in and take and seize patents. And Senators Bayh and Dole themselves expressly yes. made this point, and they said publicly that price is not to be a criteria. And I'll just add one more thing. If there is any doubt about this, there was an attempt some years ago to change the law in Congress, right? That's the way the American system is supposed to work.
Right.
You don't like a statute, okay, go to Congress, have them change the law. This was done. It was tried. They tried to change the law to add price as a criteria to the Bayh-Dole Act, and it failed. Congress refused to do it. Nevertheless, here's the administration. Somehow in 2024, somehow they see in this statute that their price can be used as a criteria when it's actually not in there in black and white.
It is amazing. Listen, unfortunately, Andre, we have to leave it there. How can folks find out more? I mean, should they go to your website? There's an organization that is dealing with this. Talk about the organization that you and David Kapos are both working with.
Yeah, so we have a bipartisan organization called Council for Innovation Promotion,
yes.
C4IP. You can go to IP.org, and there's a lot of information there. And I would urge folks, after they read the info on the website, to call their members of Congress and ask them to tell the administration to lay off the Bayh-Dole Act.
Hear, hear. I appreciate that. C4IP.org. Andre Iancu, thank you so very much for joining us. I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
My pleasure.
Take care. That was Andre Iancu, C4IP.org. I'm Andrew Langer. When we return, President Biden doesn't understand his polling numbers. I'm Andrew Langer. This is Tony Katz Today. Uh-oh. Welcome back, everybody. I am Andrew Langer, and let me just explain a little bit. I didn't realize that both Jim Edwards and Andre Iancu were going to be booked for today. I know I've spent a lot of time talking about this by Dole Marchin rule thing. It also has implications far beyond just pharmaceuticals. It's an issue that I've been working on quite a bit lately. It weighs heavily in my mind, and it is so vitally important. And it gets into this issue. The overall theme, you know, I could call the work that I'm doing at the Center for Regulatory Freedom, the Center for the Whole of Government, W-H-O-L-E, Whole of Government, because that's how they're doing this. There are 3,000 separate rulemakings in a given year, about 3,000. And the Biden administration is doing what it can to make sure that it is engaging in multiple fronts on the ideological issues that are important to them in order to remake this country. When Corinne Jean-Pierre says this president has done more in the last 3 years, that's what we're all talking about here. I don't dispute that. That doesn't mean that what he's been doing is good. And in fact, I would argue, and I think you would not be surprised for me to argue, that the vast majority of it is bad. And the funny thing is that the poll numbers bear them out. I'm going to flip these things here for a second, Jason. So first, let's hear Joe Biden himself. He was asked about these poll numbers.
Mr. President, what's your message to Democrats who are concerned about your poll numbers?
My poll numbers, the last 5 polls, you guys are in the court. I'm winning five in a row. You guys only look at the New York Times, a great paper.
So just because it's hard to hear, the president says, yeah, you know, I've been winning in the last 5 polls, five in a row. He whispers it because that's what he does. Remember, he starts off by whispering to you, and then all of a sudden he ends up yelling, and he goes, "It's no joke, folks, it's no joke. Five, you should read the New York Times. It's a great paper." The problem is, it's that New York Times Siena poll that we're all talking about, Mr. President, the one in which a majority of Democrats are saying that you're too old to be president of the United States. Not Republicans. Well, Republicans are saying that, but not just Republicans, not just voters as a whole, but Democrats are saying that you're too old. I mean, I don't know if it's a case that he is just addle-brained or he's not being briefed or some version of the two. But it really is this just gaslighting narrative that's out there. Let's play cut number 12 there. This is Lisa Rochester, the Biden campaign co-chair. Let's hear what she has to say.
What can he do to overcome this, you know, this deficit in the polls?
You know, as a co-chair of the campaign, I, you know, we take this race seriously. The president knows that this is going to be a tough race. And so we go into it with that lens. But we also know that Joe Biden has been able to accomplish things and that people are starting to see it and starting to feel it.
That's their talking point. He's been able to accomplish things. Now, what things they we've got the lowest unemployment rate in years. Guess what? People don't believe it. They don't. Because it doesn't take into account the people who have simply left the job market, who don't want to find work. You know, prices are down. Well, the inflation rate is down. But prices are still a heck of a lot higher than they were before. And the American people have no confidence that Joe Biden will make the prices go down. No confidence in that. Why? I mean, this is the maddening thing to me about this. This is what they want. This is the end result of Democratic policy. It's not a consequence. It's a feature. When you increase wages artificially, it's going to drive prices up. When you print more money, it's going to drive prices up. When you make energy become available from shaky resources, energy prices are going to go up. When you drill less for gas here at home, gas prices are going to go up, or drill less for oil here at home. And you send a signal to the marketplace that you're not going to increase oil production or allow for more refining on American soil, those prices are going to go up. That's what they want. But let me be really clear about this also. They also want gas prices to go up to push people into electric cars. Remember, I mean, this is not just the Biden administration. Stephen Cho, who was Obama's nominee for energy secretary back in 2009, he said he wanted gas prices at $6 a gallon. That's 15 years ago. They've been talking about keeping gas prices high. Real quick, because I do want to get to this. Corinne Jean-Pierre was asked whether or not Biden is going to mention Laken Riley, the young woman who was killed by the illegal immigrant. Here's what she had to say. Cut number eight, please.
Will President Biden publicly address Laken Riley's murder, allegedly at the hands of an illegal immigrant who was released by law enforcement multiple times on Thursday night? I know he's got a statement, but what about at the State of the Union?
Look, let me, I do want, this is such a tragic story and obviously situation. This is someone's life that was lost, so I do want to always acknowledge and extend our deepest condolences to her family and to her friends and the people who loved her. And so want to always be sure to say that, and because it's so tragic. Look, I don't have anything to share about the president's speech as it relates to this particular question.
Okay, full stop there. So she goes the hyperbole, you know, the baffle garb, and then she says her catch-all phrase, I don't have anything. Why do I say it's her catch-all phrase? Because the last clip I'm going to play is this one. Let's play cut number nine.
I don't have anything.
You get the picture. This is her standard answer. I don't have anything. Yeah, we get it. You're not answering questions. You're either not briefed because you're not briefed, or you just don't know. They're doing a lot of stuff that you just don't know about. Is it any wonder that Americans have lost confidence in this president? And the only people who have confidence in him are the sycophants, either in the media or the diehard Democratic voters who also want to see this country transformed into something very, very different. I mean, that's the reality out here. And so their campaign strategy is to tell the lies about what the state of America is in the hopes that nobody is going to notice. By the way, they're going to flood the oil markets with stuff out of the strategic oil reserve. Even, you know, and they're going to try to bottom out those prices right before September when folks start to go to the polls. So just be ready for that. Listen, we got a great show tomorrow. My last day here with all of you. We got Natasha Owen. She's a singer. We got Scott Shepard from the Shareholders Project, Robert Bork Jr., Devin Westhill, who's a lawyer, to talk about this stuff. Hopefully somebody to talk about the State of the Union. I'm working on that right now. I am Andrew Langer, in for Tony Katz today. As I always say, have a great night, everybody. Have fun. And please stay safe.